Radiolab is supported by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, exercising, cleaning. What if you could also be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com, Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Radiolab is supported by Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. What if we could block a protein to stop runaway cell division? Dana-Farber laid the foundation for CDK4/6 inhibitors, drugs that are increasing the survival rate for many advanced breast cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, you want to know about one of my proudest moments of being a dad?
Yeah.
Happened this morning.
Yeah.
So you know how Emil's a little bit of an introvert, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we were sort of worried whether he socializes enough. Well, we were taking him to daycare, and he's taking his shoes off. And there's this little boy who's only there 2 days a week, and he's not adjusting well. And every time his mother drops him off, she has to literally like pry him off her. And he's wailing. And you know. And so Emil sits down on this little seat to take his shoes off. The mother of this kid puts this little boy next to Emil, and he is just crying. He's just distraught. So then what happens is Emil turns to this little boy, looks at him, sticks out his hand, and says, high five. High five. Out of nowhere.
That is amazing. Yeah, because it's like they're out in their own society, you know?
Yeah,
like
totally.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's do the introductions. I'm Jad.
I'm Robert.
This is Radiolab. We're calling this show
Patient Zero.
Yeah, and for this next segment, no more patients.
No more diseases.
Exactly.
Let's focus instead on invention, on the people who bring new ideas into the world.
Yeah, the zero is behind the ideas. That doesn't quite sound right. You know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that guy you just heard?
Hi, my name is John Moalem. I'm a contributing writer at the New York Times Magazine.
He's got his own high five story to tell, though it's not about his daughter.
I think we have kids around the same age.
Her first high five. It's actually about the first high five ever.
Yeah.
Ever?
Yeah.
See, one morning a few years ago.
2007 or 2008.
John turned on his computer, opened up his email, and found
a press release about the true undisputed inventor of the high five coming, you know, out finally.
Who was the press release from?
National High Five Day, which is a kind of a joke holiday that was invented by a group of high school friends, I think.
So, and they told the story?
They told the story of Lamont Sleets. College basketball player at Murray State in Kentucky.
And the story in the press release went something like this. Sleets's father fought in
Vietnam as part of the 1st Battalion, 5th Infantry, which was nicknamed the Five. And they used to greet each other by holding up their hand and saying, Five, as a kind of prideful thing. And when Lamont was younger, they would all sort of hang out at the house in Kentucky, and he couldn't keep all their names straight. So when they'd walk in the door and go Five, he would just sort of smack their hand. And go, hi, Five.
Oh, like hi, like hello, Five.
Hello, Five, yeah. Oh. Hi, comma, Five. You know, he has small hands. He likes to put them up against the big hands of the Five guys. And it was years later that he started playing college basketball at Murray State and started high-fiving all his teammates. He'd really never stopped high-fiving. It was just something he did. But when he went around playing away games, other teams picked it up and it sort of spread out. So he was sort of both the inventor of the high-five and the kind of Johnny Appleseed of the high-five at the same time.
And within a few weeks of John getting this press release,
the story was everywhere.
Went kind of viral.
It wound up sort of all over the internet. There were some local newspapers who, you know, picked it up. You know, Murray State suddenly became very proud of the fact that they were the home of the high-five. It became sort of part of the institutional lore in the athletic department there.
And then you read this, and you thought what?
I thought, how sad.
How sad? Why how sad?
Because I knew the story of Glenn Burke.
Turns out John had already been poking around into this question of who invented the high five, and he had stumbled on this photograph.
You know what? Maybe I don't have it, but
black and white picture.
Oh, yeah. Here we go.
Two baseball players facing each other, afros, huge smiles, and their hands are in the air right about to connect. Which one of these is Glenn Burke?
So Burke's the guy in the warm-up jacket. I think he's even got his hat on backwards.
Glenn Burke was a center fielder for the LA Dodgers in the 70s. Big guy.
He says he had 17-inch biceps, so I'll take his word for that.
The other guy in the picture is Dusty Baker. He's an outfielder. But you can tell in the picture, just from the way that Glenn is sort of throwing his whole body forward, that he's the one initiating the gesture.
I mean, this is a guy who was, the soul of the Dodgers clubhouse.
He just had that type of charisma.
This is Luther Burke Davis, Glenn's sister.
With Glenn, it was like... Like he'd always be on the stage. I often said he should have been a comedian.
He was always dancing around in the clubhouse. He used to do Richard Pryor stand-up routines just from memory.
He just genuinely loved people.
So much so, she says, that in the year that picture was taken, the Dodgers made him the sort of public face of the team.
He was their ambassador of goodwill.
He's the guy they'd send out to all the press events.
You know, like meet the youngsters or people,
that sort of thing.
You know,
and stuff.
Here's the story about this picture.
What was the date?
October 5th, poetically enough, 1977.
It's the playoffs, Dodgers versus the Phillies, game four, bases are loaded.
Dusty Baker
steps to the plate.
And grand slam.
Crowd goes nuts.
Baker does his victory lap.
And just as he's...
round and third coming to the plate.
Burke comes racing out of the dugout.
And he's got his arm really high up, and Baker...
sees him, instinctively raises his arm, and before you know it...
Burke and Baker... smack hands.
Bam! There it was.
The sportscasters that were, announcing the game said they had never seen that done in sports before.
And from there on, the Dodgers started high-fiving and everyone else started high-fiving.
The high-five.
Became a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it all began with that one moment.
The platonic high-five right there.
Unfortunately... that moment?
That was actually both the beginning and also almost the end of Burke's career.
It's not that he wasn't good. He was actually really good, even in his rookie season.
He was being talked about as the next Willie Mays by the Dodgers organization.
But?
He was gay. And he tried to keep that a secret while he was playing. Dusty Baker actually had kept trying to set him up with his wife's cousins, and Burke never liked any of them, and Baker was completely confused because he knew these were really good looking women apparently. So there were rumors circulating, and the rumors reached the front office of the LA Dodgers, and one day Burke was called in by management, and they offered him $75,000 to get married.
What?
$75,000
to get married? Huh. What is this, like the mob or something?
Well,
what?
Exactly. I mean, no, they didn't regularly offer their players money to get married. And Burke's response apparently was, he said, "I suppose you mean to a woman."
Huh.
Shortly after that, the Dodgers traded him to the Oakland A's for a player who everyone acknowledged was completely inferior.
That was confusing for us, and I know it had to be confusing for him.
It was shocking to everyone. No one understood why he was traded.
And you think it was because he was gay?
Yeah, yeah.
You know, baseball is all American sport.
Yeah.
But, at least he was still going to be able to play ball. Yeah. Or at least he thought.
He ends up in Oakland, doesn't get very much playing time.
And when he did get on the field, it wasn't very pleasant.
He used to get heckled a lot, from people in the bleachers. And
even worse, according to a couple of different people, his coach,
Billy Martin,
would often introduce Glenn Burke this way.
"This is Glenn Burke, the faggot."
Really?
Yeah.
And so Glenn Burke retires.
Wow, and he was only like 26 or something, right?
Yes, he was young.
Within a year of his rookie season, just walks away.
God, that's like an aborted career.
Exactly. From there, he ends up in the Castro District in San Francisco, which is the big gay neighborhood.
And things go okay for a while.
But then one day when he's crossing the street...
three teenage girls in their mother's car...
come barreling down the road.
And they hit him and broke his leg in three places.
Oh, man.
And that kind of ended everything when that happened.
He starts taking painkillers. One thing leads to another.
He gets hooked on crack. Can't hold a job. He goes broke.
Ends up living...
on the streets.
And in 1994, Burke is diagnosed with HIV or AIDS. I guess AIDS at that point.
He ended up coming to live with me. A lot of times he didn't sleep well at night. And we would sit up and talk. Put on music and I'd dance and he'd move his arms around because he was in the bed.
Hmm.
He was bedridden.
And so you took care of him until he died?
Yeah.
Glenn Burke died in 1995.
But what he's left with at this point is he's left with the original high five, right? That's his claim.
Yes, yes. That defined him. to some people at least at the end. And he believed it. A reporter had asked him, you know, if it was true about the high five, and he said, yeah, think about the feeling you get when you give someone the high five. I had that feeling before everybody else did.
Huh. So what did you do when you got this press release?
So I called National High Five Day because I wanted to talk to Lamont Sleets. Even though I was sad, it seemed like, okay, here's another person's prideful accomplishment. Let's get his story.
Hello? Hello?
Eventually.
Hey, there we go.
He gets this guy on the phone.
My name is Greg Carroll Edge.
Greg is one of the founders, and he and John get to talking, and John asks him the sensible first question.
Is the Lamont Sleets story true?
He figured it was, but, you know, he thought he should at least ask. He's a reporter.
And there was a pause, and he said, no.
Frankly, we've been waiting for someone to ask. We thought no one would ever ask.
It's not true.
This is something that we had made up. We wanted to see if the media would run with it.
They made the whole thing up.
They made the whole thing up, and then they just went to go cast their protagonist.
Yeah, so we sat down. We picked Murray State. That's just kind of a great-sounding school. It pops up in the NCAA tournament every few years.
And they came across this guy, Lamont Sleets.
Why him?
It was pretty close to random.
They then told me they had received an email from Lamont Sleets' wife.
Absolutely. His wife emailed us and said, some of the details that you have are flat out wrong.
That implies that some of the things you've said are right, though.
But Lamont thinks he probably did invent the high five.
But wait. What about Glenn?
I was kind of like, kind of a bit blown away, you know?
Yeah. You know, here was this guy who is proud of this, and these guys just kind of stripped it away from him.
Do you feel a little guilty? Did I mean like, okay, it's a high five, it's kind of a silly thing. On the other hand, this guy's life, the way he died, do you feel like you robbed him?
We do feel we wish that we had done things slightly differently and putting together this sort of collegiate prank. But we didn't really know of Glenn Burke at that time.
Greg says they hadn't heard of the Glenn Burke story when they pulled this prank. And now that they know it, they really feel bad. In fact, they're now organizing a charity event they're calling
the National High Five-a-thon,
which will raise money for charity, including one chosen by Glenn Burke's sister, Lutha.
I'm very proud. Anytime I see somebody do a high five, it just really makes me happy.
And that seemed like a good end to the story.
But
no. Because then John told us that
if you really honestly want to get to the bottom of who invented the high five, I mean, we didn't think we wanted to, but now that we're in it, what the hell? Well, you've got to go beyond Glenn Burke's story.
I've wanted you to believe that he was the hero at this point, right? So maybe I should tell you a little bit about Derek Smith, right?
Even though Glenn Burke died believing that the high five was his legacy, at more or less the same moment that he invented it, a guy named Derek Smith, a basketball player for the Louisville Cardinals, was at practice.
And a guy named Wiley Brown went up to Derek Smith and was going to give him just an ordinary low five. And Derek Smith looked him in the eye. This is what Wiley Brown told me. Derek Smith looked him in the eye and said, no, up high. That year's Louisville team, they were known as the Doctors of Dunk. You know, they're a high-flying team. They played above the rim.
And John says when Louisville played in the 1980 NCAA Finals.
I haven't seen it, but apparently the broadcaster referred actually to the high-five handshake. Give him the high-five handshake. High-five. He felt compelled to explain it to America, you know.
Wow, and did at the moment that Derek Smith did it, did an asteroid fall on his head or something?
Well, in 1996, I believe, in the 90s, he had an undiagnosed heart condition, and he just died all of a sudden on a cruise ship.
What?
Yes. And he said explicitly to Wiley Brown, this is something I'm going to be remembered for. You know, our kids and our grandkids are going to talk about this. And in fact, our kids and grandkids do talk about it.
And they're probably very proud.
But.
It was Kathy.
Then we ran into this woman.
You let fire what?
This is Kathy Gregory. She coached women's volleyball in the 1960s, years before Glenn Burke and Derek Smith. And she says with her girls,
everyone did it.
All the time.
So I do believe that it was volleyball that first started it.
And interestingly, she says they would high five more when a player screwed up.
Yes, no, it isn't just about celebration.
Because really, when do you need a high five?
Of course, it's more when you're down.
Yeah, it makes people so happy.
So women's volleyball, there you go.
Non, ce n'est pas le fini.
Pourquoi?
Because then our producer Lynn Levy also discovered that in the movie Breathless in 1955, and exactly 1 hour, 18 minutes into the film, you will see two Frenchmen do a very distinct haute cinq right there.
Isn't this all like an indication to you that it's maybe one of those things that probably was there at the dawn of man?
because it like gives pleasure.
Yeah, it's just like
like from an evolutionary point of view.
No, I don't think so. I think this has the feeling of something that was born. See, now we have to decide, like we have to confess, like who in this room wants the gay guy to be the inventor?
I want the gay guy. Yeah,
me.
I'll raise my hand. Sure.
Yeah, it's the better story of the two, and something in me says like just go. Go with the narrative winner, you know. So
you don't even have the narrative winner.
What are you doing here? We didn't have you.
I was bored at my desk. So.
This is Pat Walters, our producer.
So you guys clearly failed at finding the first high five,
and so, you're saying you have the best.
Yeah,
there's no such thing as the best.
Yes, there is. I'm about to tell you what it is.
We've already beaten a dead horse here. All right, what is it? What is it?
Hello.
Hi.
Features this guy named Tim.
Tim Hammond.
This is him?
Yep.
Hello?
And that's his girlfriend, Katie.
Katie Schaffert.
And this little mini story begins in 2004, one July evening.
Beautiful night out.
Tim's out riding his motorcycle.
And about 10 minutes into my ride, the deer jumped out in front of me. And
he slammed on his brakes and his bike.
And just kind of like skidded. And there was a mailbox. Just snapped my neck. I woke up. I was laying in the hospital room. And I opened up my eyes and I went to lift my arm up because I had an itchy nose.
Yeah.
And my arm wouldn't move.
He was paralyzed from the neck down. And so for 7 years, Tim hasn't been able to hug his daughter. Or, for that matter, his girlfriend.
You know, we started to date after my accident. I've never been able to hold her hand or
reach out and touch me.
I mean, I feel that I'm almost in a prison.
But fast forward a few years, Tim signs up for an experimental procedure at the University of Pittsburgh. Doctors open his skull, connect wires to the part of his brain that would move his arm if his arm worked, and they connect the wires to a robot arm.
Not even Katie said or whatever, whenever she saw the wires coming out, she's like, that just looks weird.
Crazy.
And there's a video of one of the first times that Tim actually moves this arm. What you see is him sitting in a chair, doctors kind of watching, and his girlfriend Katie is just in front of him, off to the left a little bit.
They hooked me up to the arm, and the machine said,
up.
Tim kind of grimaces.
You know, my brain was sending out that specific type of signal that means up.
Yeah.
And once the computer was able to read that,
the arm
started to go up in the air.
All right.
There you go. All right.
Not long after this moment, Katie stands up from the chair that she was sitting in beside Tim and walks over in front of the arm.
And without even talking, she held out her hand.
And she says,
baby, I want to hold your hand.
And for a moment, there's this, like, stillness in the room. And then the robot arm jerks forward, just like a fraction of an inch.
Katie's hand holding up there, that was a target. To touch her hand.
And then the arm jerks up a little bit more.
You can see him going from looking at the arm.
And then a little bit more.
To looking at me and then looking at the arm.
A little bit more. Until they're touching.
When I looked at him, like, I just started tearing up and then he started tearing up.
And in a way, this high five, if you can call it that, it was sort of like the first time they ever touched.
In space and time, I was able to put this piece of machinery that looked very similar to a hand on her hand. And not only did I just touch her, but I pushed into her hand.
It was weird, too, because the hand was actually warm.
The hand was warm?
Yeah, like that's the one thing that I just kept saying to people, like it was warm, it wasn't cold. I don't know, it still kind of like boggles my mind when I think about it.
We should say thank you to Pat Walters, who
that
was kind of
not bad. Pat
nice.
Walters, not bad, not bad. But let's remember, we're after the first. We're
That's
not
right.
after the best. We're looking for the first.
And we're going to take one big leap before we finish the show and try something really odd.
Hi, how you doing?
Ah. We met a guy.
I'm Johnny Hughes. I'm a documentary maker from Britain, also a science journalist.
He's an author. He recently wrote a book
called On the Origin of Teepees. And it's about...
Teepees, why?
Well, if I'm being honest, it was because it was a sort of pun on the origin of species. Nothing much rhymes with species. But
you see, Johnny wanted to write a book about the origins of ideas the same way that Darwin wrote his book about the origin of species.
So I went chasing off after teepees.
Which brought him to the USA, and then he ended up driving across the country.
Straight across. Going west onto the Great Plains.
As he did, the farms gave way to prairie and then to wide open fields. And it was at that point that he noticed something a little different. There was a distinct change in headgear.
Yeah, as soon as you get onto the short grass prairie.
Right after Bismarck.
There's a very obvious transition from baseball caps to cowboy hats.
And that got him to wondering, like, how did the cowboy hat get to the West? Suddenly, there it is, and he's thinking, who designed it or created it or invented it? And he's decided to do some research. And at first, the answers seemed pretty obvious and actually quite simple. So here's his explanation number one.
So the answer one to the question, who invented the cowboy hat, it's straightforward.
And it goes like this. 1865, the gold rush. Colorado, everyone's coming in from all over the world to make their fortune paying for gold. They bring their hats.
So there's a sort of mixture of hats from all different parts of the world, from the north, from the south, from the cities. Quite a ridiculous collection of hats, we might say. You've got silk top hats.
No.
Seriously.
In color, in the gold rush?
In the gold rush.
That would be your Abe Lincoln hat.
Great in the East Coast cities. Pretty useless on the top of Pike's Peak.
Why? Because it gets blown off by the wind?
It's blown off, it gets wet.
So you've got your Abe, but you also have...
Raccoon skin hats, the sort of Davy Crockett things.
Great in the winter, but come the summer...
They got full of fleas, and they made you really hot as well.
That's not good.
You also had straw hats from the plantations from the south.
Which are, I don't know, kind of flimsy.
There would have been some sombreros.
Not bad, actually.
Yeah, keep the sun off your eyes, keep you cool. But they have enormous brims.
The problem is, when it rains...
Water just collects and stays on that.
There you are in Colorado with lots and lots of hats.
But none of them were perfect. All of them were slightly unfit.
Enter Mr. John B. Stetson.
He was the son of a hat maker in the East Coast. And he came over looking for his fortune. And the story goes.
When he landed in Colorado, he looked around and he immediately saw an opportunity.
Went back to the East Coast, gathered his thoughts.
And in a moment of unnatural and inspired inspiration, if you can be so inspired, he saw...
The fully formed cowboy hat.
In his head.
Yeah. So he had the model in his head.
And what was it?
So his model was, it needed to have a wide brim to keep the sun and the rain off your head. But not as wide as a sombrero, because that was impractical. But also much wider than, say, a top hat, which was useless.
And it needed to be waterproof?
Because he knew that it was wet over in the west.
Needed to have a high dome on top to keep you cool up there?
He knew what it ought to be.
So after a little hammering and stretching and cutting, he had the perfect hat. And he called it...
The Boss of the Plains.
Which everyone in the west wanted to be. So, picture the scene. Boss of the Plains arrives. It's gorgeous. You want one. You threw away your horrible raccoon thing. And you went for one of those. It very quickly became a status symbol.
That is story number one.
Pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
It was a guy.
It's a guy.
It's J.B. Stetson. He came up with the idea. He was a genius. He got it sold.
Okay. What's the problem with that story?
Well, the problem with that, says Johnny, and he realized at the moment he landed out west and he started to look into this.
Uh-huh.
Close your eyes and imagine, you know, your quintessential cowboy hat.
You asking me to do this?
Yeah, please just do it.
Okay, got it in my head.
Is it a high dome?
Yep.
Broad brim?
Very. It's got a dent in the top.
Well, see...
The picture that we have in our heads is not what Stetson invented.
Really? Why? I mean, what did Stetson's look like?
Probably the dullest cowboy hat you could possibly imagine. No rolling at the edge of the brim, no dents on the crown. It had a little ribbon around it.
Ribbon?
Yeah.
It's not very bossy. That's dainty.
So Johnny did some more research, and he now comes up. This is coming up now. Theory number two to explain who or what designed the hat. Again, 1865. It's Colorado gold rush time. People are coming in from all over. J.B. Stetson shows up. He makes the hat. But the hat was very expensive.
You couldn't afford more than one. So from then on, for the next 10 years...
You would wear it, like, all the time.
You'd be picking it up the whole time with the crown, so you'd be pushing these dents into it every time you sort of yee-hawed. And you'd also be sleeping on your hat, so you'd be folding over the brim. So within a few years, the cowboy heroes, these guys are turning up at the railhead towns with these, what we might call in Britain, knackered Boss of the Plains hats.
That looked like a completely different hat than the one they bought in the store.
Yeah. They'll be battered.
And, you know, think about this. If you're a young cowboy and you're looking for your first cowboy hat...
Do you want one that looks like the guy who runs the hardware shop?
Who's got the pretty dainty one.
Or do you want the one with a dent in it, like your dad, the cowboy?
And so hat makers picked up on this and they began producing pre-dented, crumpled, knackered hats.
Stetson responded as well. You can look through the kind of order books of Stetson, and you will see the designs change over time.
All of which is to say, if you want to tell the story this way, you can say, yeah, Stetson was there, Stetson played his part, but when it comes to a true cowboy hat, the one we think of when we think of a hat, Stetson really didn't invent it.
The cowboys did. The entire population of cowboys were instrumental in choosing the future evolution of the cowboy hat. It's almost like the market's deciding, which in this case is cowboys.
And can I just plant my flag and say that seems like a very sensible theory?
It does.
But
something about this story number two was still nagging Johnny.
Oh, there's more.
He's going to go one more round. Do you want to come with him?
I will go.
Here we go.
The third answer to the question, who invented the cowboy hat, is no one did.
Well, someone did.
What I mean is that there were no mindful decisions going on here. Not even a community of people mindfully chose where the cowboy hat was going to go.
Mindfully?
Yeah. So,
what do you suppose he means by mindfully?
This is where you get a little bit of science. You know that if you were, say, a mouse, and you were living in an environment, happily, mm-hmm. and then all of a sudden things turn cold, if you have short hair, you're going to shiver and then maybe die.
Right.
But if another mouse happens to have longer hair...
You know, they're going to do better. They're going to do better in life. They're going to have more baby mice.
So over time, in this community, you're going to get more and more and more mice with longer and longer hair.
Makes sense.
Now, these mice, they don't choose the length of their hair. They just have the hair they got. It is the weather. It is the local environment. That's what really shapes these mice. And you could think of the hat in the same way.
We're looking at the hat shape itself. The hat shape is changing over time without any forethought.
Thanks to that gold rush in the 1860s, you got a whole bunch of very different hats showing up on the Great Plains. And all those hats show up on heads, and those heads and hats are going to have horribly cold winters, searingly hot summers. They're going to be in the wind. They're going to be out of doors because the main occupation is going to be moving cattle across the plains.
Mm-hmm.
In this very competitive hat situation, the hat that's going to survive is the hat that keeps you comfortable, keeps you cool, keeps you dry. In other words, the cowboy hat. Therefore, in this third version of our story, it wasn't Mr. Stetson, it wasn't the cowboys. According to Johnny...
The environment created the hat.
The wind created the hat. The rain. The sun. The snow. The weather created those hats.
Absolutely right.
This hat was just bound to appear in that place in that time.
It would have been invented by someone, because the habitat was there. The environment was right.
There's something kind of poetic about the idea that the hat was called the Boss of the Plains. And if your third movie is correct, then it's really the plains were the boss of the hat or something
yeah,
else.
True.
Jad, that's brilliant. I like that one.
But see, on the other hand, I'm not sure I like it because, like, I'm just thinking about all the edits that we do as storytellers. Like, for the pieces in the show, like, the thing we're always trying to do is kind of get to moments, and we're trying to always atomize everything, get down to the particular person who made the particular decision that resulted in the particular change. Like, that's what we want as storytellers. So in some sense, your scenario three is like the death of story, in some sense. It's the anti-story.
Feels less glamorous, doesn't it?
Well, yeah, it runs
but you
counter.
Know what? Do you know what? When Darwin came up with the theory of, well, when he published his theory of evolution by natural selection, that felt like a death in a way, because it felt like you were taking away the creator, this amazing being, you were diminishing life to a sort of mindless process. So a lot of people criticized him for the same thing. It's not as romantic. It's not as, well, it is as awesome. It's just not in the same way.
Yeah. And come to think of it, we always end up screwing up our stories. But, you know, we start to ask questions.
And then all of a sudden you're sucked into this thing.
Suddenly it's all complicated and you have to deal with it.
You have to deal with the everythingness of everything.
Let's just keep it simple.
Once upon a time, Jad and Robert came into a show and said, that's the end of it. And you know what? It was. No, see, it's always more complicated than that, isn't
it?
It's
true. Yeah. I mean, it's never really the end. When you think about it, like, what is an end? You get the
funding
next show,
credits,
get the credits.
All these things for,
you know,
the telephone
in,
guy on
the
telephone.
They read the things, we send them to them. We should just keep, maybe just listen.
Hi, Radio Lab. This is Beatrice Hahn. Radio Lab is produced by Jad Abumrad.
This is Quammen. Our staff includes Ellen Horn, Soren Wheeler, Pat Walters,
Tim Howard, Brenna Farrell, Lynn Levy, and Sean Cole, with help from Jonathan Mitchell, Rachel James, and Matt Kilty.
Special thanks to Mike Feller, Chris Condian,
Sydney Smith, Ben Feldman,
Marva Felchin, and Katie Slocum.
That's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Okay, you all. Bye-bye.
Radiolab is supported by Cozy Earth. When you think about summer comfort, words like breezy or soft maybe come to mind. With Cozy Earth's luxurious bedding and loungewear, you'll get the comfort of home wherever you roam, allowing you to elevate your summer getaway no matter where or even if you're getting away. Cozy Earth bedding is temperature regulating and made from top-notch materials, including viscose from bamboo that can turn any living or sleeping space into a sanctuary of luxury and comfort. Their loungewear and pajamas offer you their signature level of comfort while maintaining an elegant fit so you can look cute and be comfy even if you're taking a long flight or car trip. Cozy Earth provided an exclusive offer for Radiolab listeners. Get 35% off site-wide when you use the code RADIOLAB at www.cozyearth.com. That's 35% off at cozyearth.com, code RADIOLAB. Discover your next destination for ultimate comfort at Cozy Earth.